The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. This week, it's been the worthiest dream of all the worthy dreams in Guardian Towers. But has the idea of a progressive realignment finally bitten the dust? Lib-Lab relations are looking irreparably damaged, and Labour's even flirting with diving under the duvet with the Tory right over the Eurozone bailouts. We quizzed the most professorial of progressives, David Marquand, about whether it's all gone wrong or whether instead he still harbours hopes against hope that David Cameron might be a Whig. To chew over all this, as well as hopes of Europe escaping from its current morass, we're joined by Anne Perkins and from Westminster, our good friend Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, David Marquand, as well as being a scholar of all matters political, you've been a Labour MP for 11 years and a founder member of the SDP. In other words, you've been involved in both the theory and the practice of trying to break the mould for progressive advantage. Looking around now, have you given up hope?
Not completely, but I am an incorrigible optimist. I know the facts look pretty black, but I think there is a silver lining. I think the silver lining is this, really. I think the Liberal Democrats have always had, going right back to before the Lib Dems as such came into existence in the old Liberal Party, they've always really had two wings. They've had what you might call an economic liberal wing, which is a bit like continental liberalism, particularly the Free Democrats in Germany, and they've had a social liberal wing. And what I think happened under Nick Clegg's leadership before the election was that the economic liberals gained ground and the social liberals lost ground. Nobody realised how much. Now what's happened is that the economic liberals have got into bed with the conservatives. The social liberals have been deeply upset, deeply demoralised, not knowing quite where to turn. And I think it's very possible that there could still be a different kind of realignment whereby the social liberal wing of the Lib Dems were to be realigned with Labour, plus the Greens, I think, and plus organisations like Compass, which is now non-party and is extending all over the place, into civil society. So I think the hope isn't dead, but everything would depend on what happens to the government's policies, and we don't know that yet.
And in particular, presumably, how far this cuts-based medicine goes right or goes wrong?
Well, the cuts-based medicine is only part of it. I think that is true. But I think the most shocking thing that the government have been doing from the point of view of the social liberals are the Lansley Health White Paper. I've listened carefully to what Shirley Williams has said. I've listened carefully to what Cameron and Lansley and Clegg have said. I actually cannot see a compromise between these two points of view. I think they're obviously trying to fudge one up, but I can't see how there can be one. I think it is the two points of view are starkly different.
Apart from kind of going so slow that the issue goes away, perhaps.
Well, that would be a defeat for Lansley, wouldn't it? A humiliating defeat for Lansley. Yes, that could happen, I agree.
Tell me if you think this right. In terms of your categorisation there of economic liberal and social liberal, so economic liberal, we're talking Nick Clegg himself, David Laws, perhaps Chris Huhne?
I think it's very interesting. Chris Huhne's position is very odd. I have had a lot to do with Chris Huhne over many, many years, and I have a great deal of admiration for him. He's a very, very able man. He was one of the Orange Book essayists, though, which was very much an economic liberal manifesto, if you like. I don't think he was as far out as David Laws, anything like it. So it's very hard to classify him. And similarly, Vince Cable.
And then on the other side, people like Simon Hughes and Shirley Williams you mentioned, and perhaps a lot of the voluntary party.
A lot of the party in the grassroots, undoubtedly. I mean, my wife has been a member of the Lib Dem Party for some years. She's resigned. And a lot of people are doing that up and down the country, is quite clear. And it would be very interesting to know. I mean, Charles Kennedy is an interesting figure. He hasn't really said very much, but I would put him as in the social liberal category, and probably Min Campbell as well.
Mike, when you talk to the parliamentary party, do you get the sense that there is sort of brooding discontent that could suddenly flare up amongst the kind of figures that David's talking about there?
I agree with quite a lot of David Markland said. It's lovely listening to people like him because they know so much and they've been around so much. But they, a tendency of intellectuals is naturally to intellectualize, whereas a lowly political hack myself just looks at the politics. And yes, of course, social and economic liberals, it was all there visible in the Orange Book, as David says, long before the election, that tension was there. And as he also says, it always is. It's true of other parties too, of course. But looking back to last May, whatever it was, May the 5th, May the 6th, the voters had decided that nobody should win the election, and the Lib Dem party was faced with a difficult choice. It couldn't get into bed with Labour, having lost the election quite badly, and it may have had other ways of dealing with a Conservative minority government. I think it was a bit over-enthusiastic about aligning with the Tories and a bit careless about many of the details in the hastily drawn-up coalition agreement. But it seemed to me, from the country's point of view, something along these lines was of what the situation needed. Even Vince Cable was persuaded that the Greek financial crisis meant we didn't have time to hang around. I'm a Keynesian, have always been a Keynesian, but I was afraid of the debt crisis, he said. So we got a stable government. And to be honest, I think it's too early to be too mean to them. It's tempting for journalists, and it's tempting, obviously, David Markland's been disappointed in the ways he's expressed. But it's early days to see how all this pans out, whether it's the economy, as you said, Tom, the big economic question, or other manifestations. We are where we are, and I don't entirely blame Nick Clegg for what he did, even though he's been so irritatingly priggish about what he did. It drives me mad. I have some sympathy for him, despite him.
The other half of any progressive realignment, because it's recess, I'm going to be using that phrase as often as I can, is what Labour does. Do you think that the tribal tendency in Labour has had it, not merely with Nick Clegg, but with Liberals, Liberal Democrats, whatever we want to call them, as a whole?
But again, it's the point that within political parties, as in football supporters clubs, I'm not being frivolous, there are tribal people for whom the defeat of Manchester United is far more important than the successes of Liverpool down the road, and there are less tribal people. I'm instinctively, by temperament, not a tribalist, and of course, tribalists in the Labour Party really hate the Liberals, and they've got a number of reasons for doing so, one of which, of course, is they all think that they play dirty and try to be all things to all men and women in different parts of the country. That's at grassroots, pavement level. It's an old charge, but it sticks. On the other hand, that in politics, at the end of the day, pragmatists, David Cameron's shown himself a skillful pragmatist. David Markland's rightly praised him for it. Know better than that, and know that you have to reach out beyond tribe. That is what Tony Blair so successfully did, and he won three elections off the back of it. So, no, the tribalists won't win, or if they do, they lose.
And Anne, can you see any kind of platform for a red, green, yellow coalition taking some sort of shape within the next few years?
I'm with Mike on this, in that a bit, as they say, of Kevin Peterson's lamentable form at the wicket, you don't become a bad cricketer overnight. I don't think a Liberal moment can come and go quite so quickly as David perhaps would argue that it has. But I think there's another aspect to this whole discussion which more directly relates to what you were asking me, and that's really the question about whether this kind of Liberal moment really is a Liberal moment, or is it a bit like kind of the end of the persecution of the witches, is actually just the rise of indifference towards politics generally. Nobody cares enough about anything, and certainly there's no sense that the political parties are really representing or are capable of energising people to think politically. It's very interesting that David cites Compass as an organisation which is actually managing to make an impact in what one might call progressive politics. And that, I think, is because it is working outside conventional political structures and it's looking at what people are actually doing on the ground.
David, people have written for two or three decades, haven't they, that political parties don't capture the potential political energy of citizens anymore. I mean, do you think that's more true now, or do you think it's just been true for years since, you know, the 50s, when lots and lots of people were members of the Conservative and Labour Party?
It's a tough question. I think it's a bit more true, but I think it has also been true for a long time. I think there's a terrible danger of what you might call golden ageism in conversations about this of this sort. That once upon a time there was a day when millions and millions of people were passionately concerned with politics. I wonder. It is perfectly true, of course, that if you go back to the 1940s and early 50s, the turnout in elections was enormously greater than it is now. But I'm not sure that really tells you all that much. I mean, what was going through people's minds when they turned out in elections, and what's going through their minds now when they don't turn out in elections? In other words, I think there's been a lot of scepticism in the British people. Maybe this is a good thing. In fact, I think it is a good thing, really, about the pretensions of politicians, the belief that politicians have that they can solve all problems. I think that's been there for a very long time. It's part of the national psyche, almost.
Do you think a bigger change might be if British have always shown a bit of British scepticism, and that's fine amongst the people? But is the difference now that amongst the politicians, they don't seem particularly convinced either? I mean, does Labour really believe that it's got a coherent programme for government at the moment, do you think?
I doubt it very much. I think Michael was saying that New Labour did work and it was astonishingly successful. I mean, I didn't particularly like it. In fact, I disliked it very much towards the end. But it was astonishingly successful, electorally, obviously. But what it did was an odd way to eviscerate the Labour Party, because by the end of the Blair regime, nobody in the Labour, they were glad that they won elections. But on the other hand, they didn't feel happy with this. There was something wrong, which they couldn't put their finger on. The election of Ed Miliband...
That's what they were unhappy about.
Yeah. Now, today, I mean, I think it was a very good thing for the Labour Party and actually for the country, in my view, that let Ed Miliband got that very, very narrow victory, because it's going to be very hard for David to have detached himself from the New Labour inheritance, and Ed's managed to do it much better. But so far, I mean, what is the message? The message is we are not New Labour anymore.
Yes, it's period. Disowning rather
period.
Than...
Period. That's not enough.
I just wonder whether what really mattered about New Labour was only one thing, or rather one person, and that was Tony Blair. It was Tony Blair that was monumentally successful. I mean, I agree with your analysis of what he did to the Labour Party, but I don't think it was nearly so much his political agenda as the way he presented it that... It enabled him to win elections.
Well, he was a genius. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he was a populist genius. And those sort of people only come along rarely. Thank God.
Yes, fortunately for democratic politics, really. Yeah.
Michael?
Steady on, chaps. I use the word genius sparingly, and I certainly wouldn't apply it to Tony Blair. I'm shocked that a rigorous Oxford academic would apply that word to... Roy Jenkins got Tony Blair right when he said, quoting Roosevelt or the Rooseveltian jibe, second-rate intellect, first-rate temperament, and that's what Blair had, a terrific temperament. I think there was more substance to the New Labour project than Anne and David Markwin seem to be suggesting. We can disagree about all sorts of things they did, from the Iraq War through to the civil liberties agenda, although I certainly think both charges are overstated by Blair's detractors. But a number of significant things, certainly in the social agenda, were achieved. Enormous efforts to tackle poverty, running up a down escalator. Economy for a while kept on a steady course, disappointing efforts on the environment, but some efforts, and so on and so forth. There were substantial achievements.
I mean, if that's true, and I think most of us probably accept that on poverty and things like that, there were huge achievements, isn't one of the reasons now for the great muddle and the difficulty of tracing a new alignment that would Brigade Greens, Liberals and Social Democrats together, that we know the old economic model is bust, but really not The Economist, not anyone is telling us what the new one should look like, David.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think the debate that's now going on between the parties and indeed between different schools of thought not involved in party politics is really a debate about how you get back to business as usual, in my view. Keynesians want to get back by classic Keynesian remedies, basically stimulus via budget deficits. They don't want to cut the deficit as fast and as far as the government wants to. The government wants to get back by sort of returning to quasi-Thatcherite, rigorous fiscal orthodoxy. So there's a difference between how we get there. But when I listen to the politicians in both camps, I don't detect a fundamental difference about the destination. They have not, I think, departed from the so-called neoliberal view of how economies work and what governments have to do to make them work.
And when you say business as usual, you sort of mean getting back to the chirpy days of 2006, like when it seemed like it was all working well.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody wants more regulation.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, who could be against more regulation? Everybody's cross with the bankers. Who could fail to be cross with the bankers? But what does all this amount to? I mean, this point about regulation, which has become a kind of fetish almost. Yeah, okay. Regulation isn't a sort of value neutral thing. Mm. You have to be regulating for something. There has to be a philosophical and I would say a moral view which guides the kind of regulation you seek. And I don't see much sign of that.
Mike, do you think that David's been a bit unkind on politicians? You would disagree
with
that?
I broadly follow what he's saying. It's all about pace and scale of cuts and rebalancing the thoroughly unbalanced British economy, which everybody listening about knows. Finance too proud, industry too low, as Chancellor Churchill said in 1925. Surely the issue here is that we live in a managerial age when people were voting, 90% of people were voting, 85% in the 40s and 50s. There was a very ideological patina to much political rhetoric, even though the underlying realities on the ground was a sort of Keynesian, Butzkalite centralism, corporatism, if you like, management of the economy. Now, after the great Michael Foot, Tony Benn, Margaret Thatcher decade, we've come down in towards unheroic, technocratic managerialism. I agree with Anne that politicians have lost confidence in themselves. That's why they hand over decisions to arm's length agencies like the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England and the Office of Budget Responsibility. One Brown's idea, the next one is Osborne's. So there's a loss of confidence by the political class as well as by voters in the political class. But these differences, these small differences, can often have an enormous effect on policy at every level. So even modest differences, I think, are worth proper public debate and discourse, as long as we don't exaggerate the consequences. I thought we did that, incidentally, in the AV debate, which I thought was a thoroughly dishonest debate on both sides.
Before we sort of go into a closed centre-left session, we shouldn't forget that the man in number 10 has got a few progressive claims of his own that he's made. Now, David here wrote in The Guardian, I think a year or so before David Cameron took the reins, that he might be better seen as a Whig rather than a kind of unbending Tory of the old school. I'll come back to you in a moment, David, but first of all, Anne, a year into Cameron, what's your impressions? Is he a pragmatic modelling through type of chap, or is he actually a nice smile on a fairly steely agenda?
I think he's both. I think he's pragmatic in how he achieves his ends, but I think his ends are, I agree with what is underlying your question, are a good deal more traditionally conservative than he perhaps allowed us to see or wanted us to see a year or 18 months ago. I think what's happened in this first year has plainly not been of his own making. I think that he was as taken by surprise, for example, by Lansley's ambitions for the health service as most of the rest of us. But at the same time, he was swiftly persuaded of their merits, because fundamentally I think he has this idea of a very much smaller state, and he believes that the private sector can deliver public goods.
But there is something, isn't there, Mike, that's a bit Whiggish in the kind of nonchalance that says, oh yeah, that sounds like a good plan, I'll go along with that, and then if it runs into difficulty, you maybe decide that that's not where progress lies.
Well, I suppose David Marquand would sort of define Whiggism, the pre-early 19th century, 18th century Liberal Party, as balancing tradition with the necessity of change and adjustment, that the project is never finished, rather than sort of reactionary old Toryism. David Cameron certainly fits into that mould, and he's not a radical reformer like Margaret Thatcher, obviously, who's a very odd political creature, just a very remarkable political creature, most powerful British politician since Churchill in his pomp. Cameron is pragmatic, temperamentally easygoing. I mean, the Etonian style for which their parents pay so much money, quite attractive. He looks like a man in charge of the show. He tried to be the chairman of the board, found that didn't work. Lansley's bill, you've mentioned, didn't read the small print before he wrote the foreword to it, and now he's having to do what he didn't want to do, copy Tony Blair and become a much more interventionist, hands-on chief executive. My feeling is that at bottom, he's more of a liberal Tory than a big C conservative Tory of the shires from which he springs. He's a metropolitan and I think he's more of a Whig than crypto Thatcherite.
And do you still stick with that, David?
I think he'd like to be a Whig. I'm not sure that he is now. I think the problem for Cameron is that this side of Cameron, Cameronism, detoxifying the Tory brand, all that stuff, the big society, this was all being put forward before the crisis. Mm. I think he meant it. I think he did believe in it. And I think there was something, a bit vague, but there was something in it even. However, the crisis then struck. And rightly or wrongly, he, like the rest of the coalition, decided that there was such an acute danger of a Greek-style crisis that we had to have really very macho cuts, a huge fiscal consolidation in the jargon. That's put the wiggery of Cameron off on one side. You can't really be a Whig when you're cutting on to this extent. But on the other hand, I don't think he's really a small stater in the way that Margaret Thatcher was. I mean, if you look at the small print of these cuts, which are meant to be so horrific, what are they going to do? They're going to restore the ratio of public expenditure to GDP to roughly where it was before the financial crisis in, say, about 2007. It's not going to be that different. Yes, the cuts are very big.
Yeah, in terms of though, because there's a lot of debt interest and stuff that we'll be paying that we weren't paying before.
Oh,
there's a lot more pensions for old people. And if you factor all that in...
But it makes it more difficult to cut.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're agreed. That's the point. I think if there were a second Cameron term, if the whole economic strategy works, if we're back in growth and so on by the time the next election comes, then we might see a return to the old Whig Cameron. But in a sense, there's no space for it in the economy right now. I think that's his problem.
Perhaps, Anne, you saw a hint, you know, with things like the Bloody Sunday speech, very conciliatory, that this wasn't a traditional Tory, where he gave the signal, you know, that he was prepared to say that the old Conservative and Unionist Party, if you like, had got it wrong.
Yes, I think that's a little bit of the grace that that Mike was talking about. I mean, that was undoubtedly a kind of high spot, and I think David's really put his finger on it when he talks about how limited the political space is at the moment. In a way, I think that's the thing that worries me most is the sense that there isn't, again, to return back to something David was said, there isn't a kind of sense of a moral search for a way of handling this loss of political space and the lack of options. I suppose Cameron would defend himself by saying that is exactly what he is trying to do. He is trying to find a way of doing the things that a state has to do for the least possible cost, and that is a very hard and difficult route to plan, but I don't think they've managed to convey those difficulties adequately. I think Vince Cable perhaps has come closest to being able to talk about it in a way that ordinary people can understand.
Well, we might not be able to agree with David Cameron's definition of progressive, or even agree between ourselves what progressive really means. But one thing we can probably all spot is that people who call themselves progressive are having a fairly miserable time across Europe at the moment, both in the ballot boxes, in local elections you've seen in Spain and elsewhere across the continent recently, but also in the progressive ideal of an ever closer union. And David, you've written a new book, The End of the West, which is in all good bookshops, of course, I should spell out. I've looked at your book. It seems like there's lots of reasons why things aren't going swimmingly. I'm not so sure you've quite charted a way out of the morass.
I'm afraid you're right. This is a story of my life. I can analyse the problems, but I can't produce magic solutions. I don't think there are any magic solutions, actually. I think what has happened in the last 2 or 3 years is the euro crisis is very, very, very profound. It's not just about economics. It's about politics, because the euro was always a political project, well as an economic one.
And you say it was a project of a specific kind of post-Cold War, untrammeled capitalism?
No, I don't think it was. Oh. No, not the euro. It was more complicated than that. Yes, the people who were in favour of it did believe that the Cold War was over, capitalism was now in the driving seat, there wasn't very much you could do about it, and you shouldn't try. But what I think Helmut Kohl believed, he believed in a federal Europe. Mm. And he thought a federal monetary system would be a step towards that goal. If you had a combination of a European monetary policy and a European bank running it with national control over fiscal policy, that was obviously not going to work. But it wouldn't have to work because as the pressures built up, there would
federalized
be a kind of
tax
there
as
would
well.
Be, yeah, exactly. There would be a sort of ineluctable pressure towards something more like a federal state. But that, of course, didn't happen. The member states wouldn't do it. And and particularly what's changed is Germany. I mean, Germany was really the great powerhouse of the European project. I mean, French were important, but the Germans were the powerhouse. And as far as I can see, the Germans have now changed. They now feel we've been good Europeans for far too long. We're not going to go on spending good, hard-earned German money on a lot of feckless Greeks, Irish, Italians, Portuguese, you name it. We're not going to do it. So they're in a box because either the Eurozone is going to move into some kind of political institutions, in which case that'll be a radical change in the whole European setup, or it's not, in which case I think it'll break up.
Blimey. Mike, I mean, do you sort of get the sense that the sort of Euroscepticism we're used to working around in Britain has now spread further afield?
Well, I think there's a reassertion of nationalism, as David Markham suggests, that the European project, loosely defined, grew well and unevenly, but steadily in the boom years after the Second World War, which of course are now more clearly seen as a temporary phase. The rise of Asia, the rise of China and India, and the BRICS, including Brazil, mustn't forget Brazil always, are making an enormous rebalancing of the world economy. We're seeing it in the fight over who should succeed Dominic Strauss-Kahn at the IMF, only the latest of 100 years of European owned goals, Mr. Strauss-Kahn's alleged dalliance in the hotel in New York. But the euro is indeed in deep crisis, and we're all going to be affected by it, whatever happens. And my feeling is that they'll go forward, not go backwards. But the price of going forwards and integrating the tax and spend policies, the fiscal policies of member states who are inside the eurozone, will be much greater to rescue the peripheral countries, much greater control by the European Central Bank, which is another way of saying by the government in Berlin, the paymaster. And it's going to be a very, very rocky ride, and not sure of the outcome. A breakup would be awful. I mean, they did all this because they thought we lived in a world of blocks. American bloc, Cold War bloc, Soviet bloc, now the Chinese bloc. The world has turned out to be much more fractious and fluid, but given what we know is happening in Europe, weakening share of the global economy, militarily very weak indeed, and talked about Cameron having a contemporary sense of Britain's place in the world. Well, you wouldn't know that from his Libyan policy, which appears to rely on half a dozen planes to deliver the job of deposing Mr. Gaddafi, which it won't. And I haven't even touched on the demographic projections. Europe's population, like Japan's, is getting older and weaker, more expensive to look after, more old people than young people. Scary times. We are in the grip of history. I think I've said enough, don't you?
Oh dear, oh dear. Well, David, don't you think, I mean, it's easy to talk about the breakup of the euro, and people always say, will Greece now leave? But of course, if Greece did try and leave and start printing drachma, no one would want them, and everyone would keep using euros anyway. Couldn't, I mean, isn't that one of the greatest protections? How would it unravel?
Absolutely. And another thing that would happen, of course, if it unraveled, really unraveled, would be that the Deutschmark, assuming you go back to the Deutschmark, would then rise astronomically, and the German wonderful success in exports would peter out to a halt. They wouldn't be competitive any longer, on price anyway, in world markets.
It would be a core eurozone, wouldn't it, David? I mean, they'd not go back to the mark. They'd just have the original EU6, well, and a few others perhaps inside.
Something like that. Yeah, something like that. But I mean, I agree. I think this would be a catastrophe for Europe, and it would, because it would mean that the whole European project had demonstrated a terrible failure. So I don't actually think that that will happen.
No.
But there's another aspect to these problems which we haven't touched on. I just want to say a word about them. And that, it seems to me to be a very alarming rise of an extreme chauvinistic, xenophobic and Islamophobic right in continental country after continental country. It doesn't seem to have happened in this country, thank God. But it is there in France, it's there in Germany, it's there in spades in Austria, it's there in Italy, it's there in Belgium. So that is very worrying. Denmark it's in even. The nice, sweet, lovely, democratic Danes are now turning into very unlovely
Finland,
people.
And one thing that David writes about in the book is the idea that the Europe, and correct me if I'm wrong, David, but the people at the top of Europe ducked out of doing big P politics. They kind of thought they could manage their way through this, and that in the end, it turned out that politics was the block on the integration happening. I'm just wondering, do you think that ties in with what you were saying before, Anne, about how politicians have lost faith in their own ideas?
I think doesn't it exemplify that, and I can imagine how terribly painful this is, particularly for someone like David, for whom the European project was a metaphor for the kind of post-war better world. Managerialism was, perhaps to the generation before David anyway, was very much one way of achieving this better world. It was going to be a world without politics. It was going to be a world in which fine, well-meaning and highly intelligent and well-educated bureaucrats dealt with the kind of boring business of making everything else work smoothly. And I think its failure, which I quite agree with you, was partly to do with its failure to engage properly with the politics of Europe, also actually shows that this whole idea of Europe is an idea that's no longer appropriate to the time. If you just look at the way industrial enterprise is developing now, it's not national. And nor is, for example, marketing about straightforward kind of advertising projects. It's all much more subtle, it's much more viral, it's much more, it's simultaneously infinitely more individual. It requires more input from the individual, and at the same time, it can operate on a much, much larger stage than was possible 10 or 15 years ago.
So you're saying Europe might be too small as well as too big?
Yes.
Yeah. David, we're at an end now, but I must give you the final word, because you did come in here saying you were a congenital optimist at the beginning. Try and tell Anne that she's wrong.
Well, I think she's actually, it's very difficult to tell her that she's wrong. I think that the point about politics and politicians and all that, I think she's absolutely right. You've got to realise that this thing got on the rails in the first place very soon after World War II. And the people who put it onto the rails, I think, were in a way frightened of public politics. What was public politics? Look what had happened in Germany. Look what had happened in Italy. They were scared, if you like, of the mob. And they didn't want the mob to have very much to do with this whole thing. So that, I think, is true. Now we've discovered that if you keep the mob, a.k.a. the people, out of the debate, you don't very much make very much progress. I think as to Europe being too small, well, come on. I mean, there's 500 million people. If you take the Europe as a whole, it's the world's biggest economy. It's still, despite the crisis, despite all these problems, very rich. There has been this extraordinary enlargement to the east, which seems, broadly speaking, to have worked despite hiccups. Yep. So I think it's a bit too soon to write it off.
It may be, to an extent, a victim of its own success.
There we go. We found a heartening note to wrap things up on. If you want more politics, continental or British, then you can look at guardian.co.uk. Our thanks to Michael White, to Anne Perkins and to David Markwand. The producer of this podcast was Ian Chambers. I'm Tom Clark. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.